You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week. Well, what is it about laughter? How does it affect our brain? How do we know something's humorous or not? What happens when someone tells us a joke? How do we process that information? And what does it all mean? Well, Richard Restak, author of 20 books on the human brain, former president of the American Neuropsychiatric Association and clinical professor of neurology at George Washington School of Medicine and Health Sciences, had those questions and wants to know, can humor help us better understand our brain? It is, after all, the most complex and enigmatic organ in the human body. Fortunately for us, we have Richard Restak with us to explain that. Dr. Restak, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Thank you very much, John. It's good to be here.
You make a really great point in your article about this, that if we really try to take humor apart, first of all, as E.B. White says, we're going to kill it. It's like trying to analyze the Mona Lisa by taking the particles of pigment apart down to the molecular level and seeing if there's any meaning there. So it's a tough prospect anyway, but what do we know about the relationship between humor and the brain? I mean, how is it that we decide whether something's funny or not, or do we even know that?
Well, we are distinguished from other animals from the fact that we can step back from a situation and look at it from more than one point of view. And, of course, that's exactly what a cartoonist presents us with, or a comedian presents us with, something that sort of disconfirms our expectations. You know, we all operate on the basis of what you might call scripts, or sometimes there are other terms for it. For instance, I'll say to you, let's go out to dinner, something like that, and you have immediately an idea of a restaurant and a menu and an order and eating and a bill and tipping, and it's a regular script, if you will. So what's happening is that the cartoonist or the comedian will take that script and he'll play with it a little bit. So he'll say something, well, like Stephen Wright will say something like that. I saw a bank that said that 24-hour banking, but I don't have that much time. Well, that's based on the fact, obviously, that we see these signs all the time, and they don't mean that we're going to be banking. It's going to take 24 hours to do a transaction. It just means it's open for 24 hours. So it gives you another way of looking at it, the ability to step back and see the humor of such an assumption. So that only we can do. I mean, great apes can play little jokes on each other and laugh and tickle each other, but they're not able to use abstraction and symbolism and things like that to show a discordance between what we expect and what's actually there.
So does our brain have some kind of humor center? Is there such a thing as the funny bone? Is there some part of us that processes this?
No, there is no actual humor center. There's the temporal lobe of the brain is the part of the brains of the ears on both sides, and that's where these scripts are sort of embedded, if you will. And the frontal lobe, which is on the forehead, that's the part that sees the discordance between what the script will call for and what's actually happening, what the comedian is presenting you with or the cartoonist is. So there's no center. There's an interesting study that was done, I mentioned in the American Scholar article by Dean Mobbs, who's now at Columbia University. He took cartoons and he removed the amusing component from it, and then he showed these cartoons to people while he had them in a functional magnetic resonance imager, which shows brain activity. And he saw that there was differences between the funny cartoon and the one that wasn't so funny. And the way he did it, as I said, was just subtract the funny aspect of it. And he found that the subcortical, or the what we think of limbic system or basal ganglia system, or part of the brain that's below the cortex, actually lights up. And this is the pleasure center as well. This is what happens when we have pleasure from any particular activity. That's the part of the brain that becomes accentuated.
Mm-hmm. We've often heard that laughter is the best medicine, and that people with a positive outlook and who laugh a lot seem to be healthier. We may ascribe that to the category of old wives' tales. Is there truth to that? I mean, do people who laugh more, are they more mentally healthy? Or, well, I'm going to subtract maniacal laughter from that. But so leave mad scientists out of this. But for the average population, those of us who find more humor in life, are we going to be on the average healthier mentally? Do we know that?
I don't think there's any question about that. I'm absolutely convinced of it. There are many laughter associations and workshops around the world. This thing called the yoga laughter, in which is a form of yoga, in which it simply accentuates laughter. I mean, if you get one person and sit them across from another one and they're staring at each other, and neither of them says anything, but one of them starts laughing in a hearty way, I mean, soon the other one will start laughing too. It's infectious. And it does all kinds of good things for the body, I mean, in terms of the diaphragm, the abdomen, the facial play, and all this. Breathing patterns are changed. So it's very good, and it's also a great stress reducer. Now, we're not talking about, you know, cynical, wry kind of comments, things like that, ironic. None of that. I'm talking about the, you know, laugh-out-loud kind of humor. That's the kind of thing that's really good for you.
Well, gee, irony is my stock in trade, so I'm really in trouble now. I made you laugh. And the going back to what you said, though, laughter being infectious. I mean, we've all experienced this. Why is that?
Well, we don't know precisely. It's sort of tickling. You know what Darwin referred to humor as a tickling of the mind, and it's sort of a tickling of the subcortical areas that I talked about before. That's what laughter tracks are all about. I mean, that's why from the very beginning of television, they used to have the laughter track. Somebody would say something funny, and then there would be the canned laughter, and that would cause you to laugh as well as you were watching it, because you heard laughter, so that it has an infectious quality. If you get one person laughing, you'll get another, and that's exactly what happens in these laughter associations and the workshops that I talked about. Somebody will just get up, and they'll just start laughing, and soon other people will be laughing as well. So there's the infectious quality to it.
What is it, though, that, I mean, we don't all find humor in the same things. Two people can look at the same cartoon or hear the same joke. One will get it and laugh, and another one won't. Is this just a function of how we were, of what our cultural background might be, or the way we process language,
or
images?
It's really all of those, actually. I mean, it's hard sometimes to get humor in another cultural expression of it. In other words, you see a cartoon that is poking fun at something that's really integral to the particular culture, and you're not familiar with that culture, you're not likely to find it funny. But you also make the point that different people will look at something that everybody will agree is amusing, but one of them is just laughing is to tears, and the other one is just sort of, you know, smiling and is even sort of embarrassed by it. These are the differences in, we all talk about there are certain people with no sense of humor. We say, gosh, he's very acute sense of humor, and you feel good being around people that laugh a lot and have a sharp sense of humor, but there are other people that don't find much of anything. Of course, then there's the cultural aspect in our own culture. I mean, I mentioned in the article about the fact that in the workplace, it's only the boss that can make jokes. I mean, you know, humor typically starts at the top. If anybody else makes a joke, then everybody looks over to see how the boss is taking it. So there's sort of a hierarchical aspect to it, which is not a good thing, but you obviously couldn't have an organization running where everybody was constantly making jokes.
Oh, unless it was an organization whose output was comedy, in which
exactly.
case...
Exactly. Well, absolutely.
Everybody would
have to. I was up there at the Comedy Cellar one evening at the comedy table with three comics from Comedy Cellar, and that's exactly what was the value for everyone, to say things that were funny, and it was an awful lot of laughter. So that this was part of the whole deal, where laughter is sort of, if you will, the product, the commodity. I mean, this is what everybody's producing and trying to get illicit laughter from others.
Mm-hmm. Do you have an example of something that would be universally funny?
Well, some of the things that, you know, that people used to show in some of the silent movies, people slipping on banana peels and things like that, you know, humor changes so that what was funny at one time is not so funny now. So that's another thing that's really great about the relationship of humor and the brain. I mean, it evolves, I mean, in a positive and negative way. In some of the positive ways, I mean, we no longer tolerate humor based on ethnicity or physical or mental disability, we just say that's really not funny, and it isn't funny. But there were times when there was all sorts of jokes along those lines. So humor evolves just as our own sensibilities and sensitivities evolve as a culture and also individually.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask our callers to get involved in this discussion, because I'm sure that a lot of people are going to have questions about this. 800-486-8655 is the number to use our conversation here. 800-486-8655. You can also reach us via email, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And you can find the Kathleen Dunn Program on Facebook and leave a comment or question for Dr. Restak there. You mentioned a little bit about, we touched a little bit on tension release, that humor helps us to release tension. That's actually one of its health benefits, I would think. But there are other theories of humor that you discuss in your article. One of them is the incongruity resolution model, and I think you touched on that very briefly as well. But the one that I wanted to really have you take a look at and discuss maybe in a little more detail is the superiority theory, because I think this is one of the main areas where in everyday situations we find humor.
Well, it is, and it's the laughter is involving oftentimes other people's mistakes or misfortunes or stupidity. And I made a reference a moment ago to somebody slipping on a banana peel, everybody finding that so funny to watch somebody fall. I mean, it's not so funny if you're the one falling, but, I mean, there is this superiority theory. We'd say, well, you're laughing because you didn't fall. You wouldn't have fallen. Someone else did. I mean, this is actually Plato. You can go back as far as Plato, who commented on this sort of humor, where we have the unfortunate aspects of or the unfortunate things that happen to other people do provide some level of humor. That's just one of the theories of it.
And sometimes we make jokes about ourselves, perhaps as a defense mechanism. We make the joke first rather than having someone else make it. It doesn't, whatever defect we're revealing about ourselves, it doesn't hurt as much if we do it as if someone else does it. And the classic example for me has always been Cyrano de Bergerac's famous speech about his nose.
Yes, right. If anybody else said that, he would have been angry.
Well, right. Yes, he probably would have offered to fight them to the death. But he makes this long monologue, and it's hilarious.
That's right. Well, self-deprecating humor is very popular now, and I think it's an evolution that humor has taken. However, a lot of times it slips into cynicism and things like that. We talk about irony. It's nothing wrong with irony. I love irony, but it's not the same as a belly laugh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get that a lot. We have Betsy on the phone with us. Let's take a call here. Betsy, good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
I had to put that in there.
That's good. It's got me laughing.
I'm a laughter yoga leader.
Oh, you are?
Yes.
Tell us how that works. Yeah, go ahead, Betsy. Tell us how that works.
It was developed by a family physician in India, Madan Kataria, and he started using laughter as a healing, a method of healing, and the studies around the world that show the benefit of laughter are just overwhelming, releasing endorphins, serotonin, natural painkillers, all kinds of things. And his wife was a yoga instructor, and so she said, you need to get some yogic breathing in there to help these people when they're laughing so hard.
That's right.
So the yoga part is the yogic breathing techniques.
Okay, so if I was to attend a yoga laughter session, what would describe
yoga.
The experience?
Yep, laughter yoga. Yoga.
Well, it described to me what sort of experience I would have.
It's a very, very positive experience. As you've already mentioned, the laughter is contagious. So we would do various, I guess you can call them, exercises that include laughter. So it's not jokes, because as you said, everybody has a different sense of humor. It's pure laughter. So we might do something that one of my favorite ones is to go through the vowel. It's called vowel movement. And for each vowel, you laugh it. So, and you go through all the vowels, but you laugh them. Mm-hmm. And your body doesn't know the difference between, you know, laughing at a real joke that is funny versus just pure laughter. You get the same benefits. So it's fantastic.
Betsy, thank you for sharing that with us. That seems a little counterintuitive, Dr. Restak, in terms of if there really isn't something funny, if I'm manufacturing the physical aspect of laughter, do I get the same benefit, really?
Well, this goes back to a very deep question in psychology, the James Lang theory about emotion. Is are you frightened when your lion is coming after you, or is it actually the fright that comes first or the lion that comes first? In other words, which is happening first? If you mimic the diaphragmatic movements, facial movements, and all this of laughter, I mean, it will bring about, as the caller mentioned, these positive effects with neurotransmitters and things like that. So that just doing the physical thing, you're just, in other words, sitting and not making any kind of physical movement, it's really hard to appreciate the full extent of humor because there's a bodily component to it, diaphragm and face, breathing patterns, and all this sort of thing is intermixed with the experience of laughter and humor.
Well, I think anybody who would take a look at me trying to do downward dog would probably get a belly laugh out of that. And I realize that's self-deprecating, but forgive me. We'll take a break. When we come back, perhaps some more listeners will want to join us. Betsy, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us this afternoon. You could be next at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. That's the number to call to join the program. So what do you find funny? What do you think that says about your brain or about your personality? How do you feel? You know, I mean, I'll just toss this out to the listeners. And what is it? How do you determine what do you think happens? Let's get that, and we'll have Dr. Restak maybe respond to some of your ideas of what does it make you feel like when you have a good laugh? How do you experience humor in your life? 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We'll take a short break. When we come back, we'll have your calls, emails to talk@WPR.org, and a Facebook post. Go to the Kathleen Dunn Facebook show page, and you can leave your comment or question there. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. Dr. Richard Restak is my guest. We'll be back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about the effect of humor on the brain, laughter, and the brain this hour. My guest is Richard Restak, author of 20 books on the human brain. He's former president of the American Neuropsychiatric Association and clinical professor of neurology at George Washington School of Medicine and Health Sciences. We have lines available for you if you'd like to join the conversation at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or you can do what Greg did and post to Facebook. And Dr. Restak, here's a question that I was on my list as well, so good going, Greg. Way to read the host's mind. What about people that cry when they laugh? Is that healthy? And does this tell you anything further about that person? I mean, I think we've all experienced, we laugh until we cry. Is that just part of the release, or is there something else going on there?
Positive and negative. Some people will become, like the Speaker of the House, has had a few episodes under happy occasions of crying, and crying doesn't necessarily mean sadness. It can be, as you just mentioned, and as Greg mentioned, it could be a positive experience. We always also talk about someone being overwhelmed with emotion, and that can be a positive emotion where they're really something so wonderful happened. They've just won the sweepstakes. And what do? They start crying. I mean, we've seen people going up to get an Oscar and they're crying. I mean, it's not a sad event. So, in other words, tears don't necessarily link in with a negative emotion. They can link right up with a very positive emotion, and along with laughter. You can laugh yourself to tears. We use that phrase, you know, we just laugh to tears about such and such or so and so.
800-486-8655. If you get a busy signal, send us an email, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Humor, as we've talked about it, is complicated. And it, as you point out in your article, it makes pretty heavy demands on the brain. So maybe, in a way, I guess, it's work for us, but it's work we like.
Well, it is. In fact, I use humor to evaluate patients. First of all, when they come in, I show them a series of cartoons. And, you know, the thing about a cartoon is you can't fake whether or not you appreciate a cartoon. You can hear a joke that you kind of half understand it, but you don't understand it all, the whole way. But a cartoon, you either get it or you don't. So I like to show people cartoons and say, what is going on in this picture here in this cartoon, or tell a joke. But as I mentioned in the article, the humor is so heterogeneous. Each of us has a different type of humor, just to be each of a different brain and a different brain processing, and find different things amusing, so that I use humor in terms of cartoons, in terms of jokes, and when I evaluate patients, actually, and show them a picture, you know, so you explain this picture of usually a cartoon-type situation.
You know, I use humor to evaluate doctors.
Yes.
If I can't make you laugh within 5 minutes on our first appointment, I know we're going to have a problem.
I think you're absolutely right, and for a long time there used to be discussions in the psychiatric community about whether or not psychiatrists should make jokes about, you know, or respond with humor when they hear something, and it's actually still a lively discussion about it, and I share your view. I think that when the doctor is willing to show some humor and appreciate humor in the patient, and vice versa, it facilitates the whole arrangement. I think the only thing that would be negative would be if the patient felt that the doctor was making a joke about something and making fun of the patient. And of course, that's not humor. That's some sort of ridicule or sarcasm or something like that, which is not humor.
Yeah. Let's, the phone's just all of a sudden really lit up, which is always something we like to see. Let's go first to Cornell, where Bill is on the line. Bill, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to relate about a group laugh experience. Years ago, group of us seven were in a car club and went to a show down in Madison, held a theater of approximately 150, 200 people. The movie was Lolita, a serious movie. The buddy next to me starts giggling. I start giggling. We had the entire audience giggling in the show, and there was nothing even to laugh about. Everything was serious.
Yeah, I bet everybody felt better, too.
Funny. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah, that's the infectious quality of it. And of course, that's why students, you know, I mean, and teachers in grade schools, in the old grade schools at least, they used to, you know, when they knew if one student started laughing, they'd all start laughing. So soon the class would be, quote, out of control, as the teacher would put it. But actually, they're having a lot of fun.
Well, and of course, and Bill's call reminded me of the famous Mary Tyler Moore episode with the laughter in an inappropriate place. And of course, we all laughed at the episode. She's laughing at a funeral and can't stop herself. And we find that funny because it's so inappropriate.
Right. It's inappropriate. In fact, there was a famous case of a brain tumor that had actually manifested itself by the fact that somebody started laughing at a funeral. And it was noted that there was no mirth connected, but there was just an automatic laughter. So it was from a pineal tumor. But I mean, that would sort of argue. You'd say, well, I thought you told me a bit ago there wasn't a humor center. Well, it wasn't a humorous thing. It was just simply an automatic expression of laughter, which had no context.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Marie in Madison. Marie, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to share a kind of a lifelong experience of how laughter has helped me and my children. We're victims of severe domestic abuse to the point where we still are being stalked for more than a decade now. And, I mean, I was killed at one point through it and everything, very serious. And without us learning to laugh at ourselves and at each other and being able to find the humor in every situation, I don't think any of us would have survived. And it just has always amazed me that the laughter just, you know, it turns to tears and tears can turn to laughter, but it just kept us alive and is still keeping us alive to this day. So I just suggest everybody learn to laugh at yourself. It'll keep you alive.
Marie, thank you for sharing that with us. Dr. Restek, laughter a survival strategy?
Well, it can be. It sounds like a tragic situation this caller was involved in, which meant that there was some individual obviously perpetrating this. They may not be, amenable to anybody laughing about them, but I guess the humor would be shared among the people that would be victimized. So it's a very unusual situation, as we both recognize listening to it.
But what about, for example, when someone passes away? Okay, and we maybe not at the religious part of a funeral service, if there is one, but certainly at a wake, when people will get up and share memories about the departed. And usually there'll be something, at least some people will share something funny, some habit that the dearly departed had that we can all laugh at. And perhaps in this case, laughter is a way to process our grief.
Absolutely. And that's what Irish wakes are all about. I've attended many of them, and you hear some great jokes, and people get up and tell stories, or you say, that have humor. And, of course, it counterbalances the heavy sorrow that some people feel. And even those that are the most bereaved will feel so much better by laughing. So it gets back to your original question, do people feel better when they laugh? There's a dramatic example of the fact that people will feel better. They'll say, you know, this wasn't when I finally heard that story about Sean, and when he said this or said that, and then it brought back the memory, and then they started laughing. And they also, as you also mentioned a moment ago, they may also start crying. And there'll be a mixture of laughter and crying. You see that often at wakes.
And so we feel better then when the laughter and the tears that come from laughter are part of the sadness, and it helps us perhaps to release that?
Absolutely. They're merged one into the other. And the experience is a mixed experience in terms of you've got the bereavement, you've got the sorrow, you've got the sense of loss, but then you also see this funny part of the person who's now gone and the things they said and did that other people laughed about at the time. Now we're laughing about it again, so it brings them back in a composite, a pleasurable composite that the person will experience in a pleasurable way.
What about nervous laughter?
Yeah. Right. Well, that's the other thing about laughter. Sometimes it's just like a reflex. I mean, sometimes when you're the most tense, you'll laugh, you'll giggle, you'll do this. It's sort of what we call a leakage of the emotion, where you're not really feeling amused. In fact, you usually feel threatened in some way, and you'll let out a nervous laugh. So, yes, that's the laughter can be. But it's not a belly-rolling type laughter. It's more, you know, just a nervous, like a little twitch, if you will. It's a vocal twitch.
A titter.
Titter, yeah, tittering. That's right.
It's an old-fashioned term.
Yeah, right.
I'm just an old-fashioned guy. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Lines available for you now if you'd like to call in with a question or a comment. Share your experience of laughter and what it does for you. Maybe you can give us an example of how laughter helped you out in some way, or you've got a question about what it all means. Dr. Restek is well able to, I think, answer those questions. 800-486-8655. Benjamin is on the phone with us from Milwaukee. Benjamin, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Great show. Thanks for taking my call. I'm an amateur comedian, and I like to put in my comedy, I like to try and always put some forward thinking. Like, I talk about health reform or politics, and I've personally found that if you can get someone laughing, they're much more open to new ideas. That's why I've always said that the modern-day philosophers, the Aristotles, the Platos, are stand-up comedians. Because they're the only modern equivalent to someone people will come from miles around just to sit and listen to what someone's opinion is on a topic.
Yeah, absolutely. We use terms like disarming humor. I mean, that's a phrase. His humor is disarming. I mean, it's like, you know, he makes an enemy into a friend because he says things in such a way that they're comic and the person, it's a social, uniting people rather than dividing them.
Benjamin, thanks for that call. And I just thought of my one psychiatrist joke.
Okay.
My psychiatrist told me I was a self-absorbed narcissist, and I said, why should I care what you think? But I'm bump. I'll be here all week.
There we go.
Is there a science showing the difference between laughter in men and women? Are there gender differences in terms of how we respond to humor and laughter?
Absolutely. I mean, there's the men, they appreciate women who laugh at their jokes, and women appreciate men who are funny. Now, it's been shown in a study that men's humor, of course, is a little bit more of a, we call it hostile or interested in, we talked about self-deprecation and things like that, slapstick humor, while women prefer funny stories. Now, in marriages, it's been shown that when the marriage is under stress, that if the woman makes a joke about it, and it actually is uniting and helps them, but if the man makes a joke about it, it's not as good. Greater incidence of divorce and separation, and when women use the joking.
Interesting.
But it's speculated that the aggressive humor of the man, in times of turmoil, or stress, adversely affects the bonding between the partners. So there's a difference between the humor of men and women. There's no question about it.
Let's take a call next from JT in Milwaukee. JT, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon. Yeah, I just wanted to mention one thing that I find at my job all the time. I'm a plumber, and I generally, if you have to call the plumber, you're already in a pretty bad mood. And I walk into situations where the people are concerned, they're worried about how much they're going to be charged, what's going on. But if I approach it with a nice big smile on my face and throw a little humor at it, it calms people down right away. And I've had a really great customer base built up just right off of that.
That's great. And, the other point I mentioned in my article is that why don't we hear jokes anymore? A lot of people don't tell each other jokes because they're afraid that something in it may be offensive, or because we're also sensitive now to various things. But it's great, your idea of going in and immediately establishing a bond with the person who's hired you. It sounds great. Good.
JT, thanks for the call. There's a certain element of risk in telling a joke. I mean, if you or doing something you think is humorous and it falls flat. I have a tremendous admiration for people who will stand up in front of a crowd and tell jokes, because your ego is right out there. You could take a big beating if people just, you tell a joke and it falls flat. Of course, the really great comedians were able to make a joke out of that. Johnny Carson was famous for it.
Yeah.
A gag would die, and he'd get a look on his face, and then that would get the laugh.
That's right. Well, I guess it's Steve Martin calls stand-up comedy the ego's last stand. I mean, you can go out there, and not only can they're not laughing, they can boo you off the stage. I mean, you can really have a terrible experience. And the late Jonathan Winters, of course, had a terrible experience, and we wound up in a psychiatric hospital after having a nervous breakdown because during a performance in 1959, I think it was. So yeah, it's a very, very how would you call it, a high risk occupation, a stand up comedian. I mean, the speed of your response, and you've got to deal with hecklers, and you've got to have working memory, meaning you're juggling all kinds of information, and you've got to have great control of what we call prosody, in other words, the tone of voice and the way things are said. How fast they're said, all these various things. It's masterful.
Mm-hmm. Let's, we're just about at break time, so I'll hold off taking another caller until we take a short pause here. But we will have more of this discussion about laughter and the brain and how we process humor as human beings. We do it differently than any of the other animals. We're kind of asking some of the questions, why is that, and what is it about humor that affects us the way it does? Dr. Richard Restak is my guest. You can join us. A line available for you right now at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to this program on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, it's Laughter and the Brain. My guest is Dr. Richard Restak, author of 20 books on the human brain, former president of the American Neuropsychiatric Association and clinical professor of neurology at George Washington School of Medicine and Health Sciences. And again, full phone lines. This is great. Let's go next to Waukesha and talk to Mark. Mark, good afternoon.
Hello.
Yeah, hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Can you hear me? Okay, good question for you, or actually a statement. A few years ago, I read a book, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat by Dr. Oliver Sacks. And in it, he had a section on idiot savants and a story about a sort of an emotional, poetic savant who I guess was an idiot savant, but would write beautiful, empathetic poetry. And I'm wondering what the relationship is. I always thought there was a relationship between humor and empathy. And if you could consider, you know, somebody like a Robin Williams almost to be like a humorous savant.
Well, there's no question that some people have highly developed senses of what's humorous, and they can, you know, their mind reacts very quickly. Their frontal lobes have a, you know, enhanced working memory. And I talked a little bit earlier about script being disconfirmed. I mean, they can, you know, take something and then turn it and twist it in a funny way so that you find amusing. You didn't sort of think of it that way. And those people that do that for a living are stand-up comics, and you know, Robin Williams is one of the ones that is preeminent in that area. So Steve Martin too.
And Mark, thanks for that call. What about one of the things that you write about in your article when you discuss injuries to the brain that can have an effect on how we perceive humor is something the German word for it is Witzelsucht, which sounds like an addiction to wisecracks.
Right, right. Well, a good example of it is that there was a patient who had damage to their frontal lobe, which is the part of the brain which, as I said, looks for, you know, compares things and finds the humor. And there was a picture of a casket, and below it were three faces. One had a smile on it, one was neutral, and the other was laughter. And you asked this individual what one of these faces goes with the picture of the casket. And he said, well, the smiling face. And the physician was puzzled, and he said, well, why do you say that? And he responded, because it's not me in the coffin. So that's Witzelsucht.
Okay.
Bizarre right. One-liners and slapstick. That's an unusual way to put it. It's that comes from an actual lesion in the brain.
Mm-hmm. Which also then raises the issue of appropriate and inappropriate humor, which is always contextual.
Yes.
And as something may be appropriate in one place and not appropriate in another. But sometimes the fact that something is inappropriate makes us laugh even harder.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, the little kid that says something that everybody else is thinking, but no one says it. That's the best example. They parents and people around try to ignore that it was said, but then suddenly you realize how appropriate it is, and you were thinking it yourself, and you start to laugh.
Out of the mouths of babes.
Yeah.
And Art Linkletter made a career out of that.
Yes, that's right. Getting children to say things that were...
Yeah, kids say the darndest things. I don't know how many volumes of that may still be in print someplace.
Yeah.
Mark, thank you so much for your call. Let's go next to Kathleen in River Falls. Kathleen, hi. How are you today?
Good afternoon, John. I am terrific, and I am thoroughly enjoying your program this afternoon.
I'm glad to hear it.
A couple times ago, mentioned something which spurred a story that I'd like to share with you. My husband has a very nervous laugh whenever he was under pressure, under stress. Well, one day at work, his supervisor called him into his office to discuss a problem that he had with something that he had done. Well, he proceeds to, with his little laugh, and pretty soon the supervisor is irritated, and he dismissed him for a whole week of work because he didn't think he was taking him seriously. And the whole issue was just the fact that he didn't understand that that was just his way of expressing his nervousness.
Yeah, that's the twittering we were talking about earlier, tittering. The letting out the laughter, which the other person probably felt they weren't being taken seriously and maybe even thought it was a hostile act, and then responded, it's too bad, really, it's a shame.
Twittering would be laughing at a pace of 140 characters.
Yeah, that's right. That'd be twittering as opposed to tittering. That's right.
Yeah. Kathleen, thanks for sharing that story. I hope your husband was able to keep his job. Good luck on that. Let's go to Terrell in Delavan. Terrell, good afternoon.
Hi. Yes. First-time caller. Awesome. I'm glad I got on. But my question was about emotional incontinence. I had read a study once about people who will hear a joke or something and laugh way too much or think it's way more funny than it really is. And if you've come across any, like, diseases or something like that, that is linked to, people who overreact to humor or sadness or anything like that.
What do I think of people who overreact to humor? I think they're probably self-stimulatory, if you will. They start to laugh, and then they're hearing themselves laugh, and then that causes more laughter. So there's a feedback mechanism. It would be interesting to take a person like that and put a pair of earmuffs on them or so otherwise occlude their hearing. And I suspect they wouldn't laugh much, and if they did, it would be a short-lived laugh. That's an interesting experiment, which I just thought of now as we talked about, seeing whether people can laugh when they can't hear themselves laughing.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, I think let's do it, John. We'll
well, there you go. What is the sound of one hand clapping?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Terrell, thanks. Thanks so much for that call. We had an email from Donna in Madison, and this goes back to appropriate and inappropriate humor. If she wants to know if making fun of other people, say derogatory humor about women or minorities, is appropriate or has a place.
Well, I don't think it does. It certainly doesn't in contemporary society, and it's been gradually eased out. You hardly hear it. I mean, but you do occasionally hear it in clubs and things like that. I mean, what we've done is we've formalized and licensed humor, you know, so professionals such as comedians, cartoonists and all that, they kind of play the role of medieval court jesters who could say anything they wanted to the king, and the king would agree that he wouldn't punish them because that was their job to do this. And, of course, we have things like correspondence dinner every year, and we have a comedian there who says things to the president that nobody else would say, and the president apparently doesn't get too upset, although when Stephen Colbert was giving the humor in 2006, apparently George W. Bush was pretty upset, one of his aides said he was about ready to blow, so I don't know. it's a delicate line. That's what these so-called roasts, when you go, people are go to a dinner where they're going to be feted and made a fuss over, but they're also going to be chided and made fun of a little bit. And it's a thin line. It's a very delicate line to not step over.
Well, and there are trends in humor. For quite a long time, there was a trend the blonde joke was in.
Yes.
There are entire volumes of fill-in-the-blank humor. So
yes,
we've got Norwegian jokes and Polish jokes and German jokes and name an ethnic group. There are those.
Right.
And jokes about certain occupations. How do you get the drummer off your porch? You pay him for the pizza. You know, that kind of thing. But there is a line. There is a line between, okay, some of those are okay, but some are not. And sometimes some people have trouble distinguishing that. And what's different about them? Why don't some people understand where those lines are and others seem to?
People differ in their ability to read social signals. Someone mentioned autism a bit ago. That's an extreme of inability to read social signals. But there's a lot of people that certainly aren't autistic and they seem to be otherwise normal. But they don't realize that, you know, either people aren't laughing at the joke, or if they are laughing, they're doing it in a pro forma kind of stilted way. They're uncomfortable, or they have like a nervous response, a nervous laughter, as the caller mentioned a few moments ago. So, you know, these are the factors to be taken into account.
Let's go next to Minong and hear from Fred, who's on the line with us. Fred, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I've noticed in a lot of people, unfortunately, they seem to gather a great deal of pleasure from laughing at people rather than laughing with people. And I'm wondering if that has something to do with their brain makeup or just their personality.
Well, that's one of the three theories that we talked about a little earlier. That's the superiority theory, based on mirth and laughter is based on other people's mistakes, misfortunes, or stupidity, and therefore that's what they make the laughter based on. That goes back, for, you know, back to the Greeks writing about it. Plato wrote about it. So it's just part of, you know, the human nature. We're going to make things because we say, well, I find it funny because I couldn't see that happening to me. I'm too smart.
Yeah. Fred, thanks for the call. Here's an email from Donald who writes, TV sitcoms persist in playing off someone fumbling to hide their mistakes. What's funny about deceit?
What's funny about defeat?
Deceit, dishonesty, covering up.
Oh, deceit, sorry. Yeah, that's true. Now, of course, the person that asked that question is, you know, taking a very serious view of it. I mean, deceit can be funny. I mean, you know, somebody can be telling a story that involves a little bit of harmless deceit that is, you know, it's not that big a deal. I mean, and it can be amusing because the different ruses that people take. I mean, I have a joke comes to mind right now, but it'll take too long to tell it. But you know, the deceit about.
Well, you can go back to the Greek playwrights like Plautus, who basically invented the situation comedy, where, you know, mistaken identity, deceit, the whole commedia dell'arte, the classic characters like, you know, the father in Scaramouche and whoever. There was always a lot of romantic deceit going on. And, oh, we can't let father know that these two people are together. And there's all sorts of funny things that happens as they try and keep someone from finding out what's happening.
Yeah. Well, you know the joke about that's my story and I'm sticking to it. That's the punchline. Of course, the working up to it by someone hiding something from a spouse, and then they make up another excuse, and each one is discovered to be false, and they finally end up with the punchline, well, that's my story and I'm sticking to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, no show about humor would be complete without a lawyer joke. Let's go to Pat. Let's go to Pat in Marshfield. Pat, let us have it. We're running out of time.
Okay, what can a goose do that a duck can't do that a lawyer ought to do?
What's that?
Well, he ought to stick his bill in his butt.
Oh, my goodness. We had to wait 56 minutes for that. Pat,
right.
Thank you. Thank you so much. The bottom line here is that there's a lot more that we need to know about the brain. I mean, there's a lot of the brain that's really still terra incognita. As much as we've learned, perhaps what we've learned is that we still don't know a lot. What's next for you in terms of where you're going to continue to do this kind of research to find out what effect humor has on us and how we process it?
Well, I may expand this a little bit into a small book. This was in the American Scholar, and I may do a little small book on it if someone's interested in doing that, because there's enough there. I just scratched the surface of it.
Mm-hmm. And what was, as you were, as you're thinking about this, what is the thing that that has maybe surprised you? Did you have an aha moment as you were considering all of this stuff?
Well, I thought that the subcortical, the emotional parts of the brain were the most important part of it, and the pleasure centers, because, you know, that's what you're getting. You're getting pleasure out of humor. Why do people go and spend money to go to a comedy club to listen to a comic? Because they get pleasure out of it, and they enjoy it. So that was a part that wasn't a surprise to me. It was a very delightful confirmation of what I had kind of suspected.
Do you have a favorite one-liner that you like to use to illustrate humor?
Well, I one of my favorite comedians is Stephen Wright, and his stuff is, you know, filled with, like, I bought batteries, but they weren't included, so I had to buy them again. I mean, you know, it's kind of, you know, off. You have to think about it a little bit. He's the thinker's comedian, I think.
Intellectual humor.
Yeah, well, the intellectual humor is a genre of humor, which some people are either incapable of appreciating or they just, you know, don't like it.
Well, the funny thing about radio programs is that we eventually run out of time, which is what's happened in this case. Dr. Restek, thank you for a very enjoyable hour this afternoon. It was good.
Well,
to
I've
talk
enjoyed
to
it too. I mean, you had a few laughs. I think you have too. So
we have. It's been what a great way to end my work day, if that were in fact what I was doing. But appreciate it. Thank you so
good
much.
Good job. Thank you. Bye.
Richard Restek is author of 20 books on the human brain, former president of the American Neuropsychiatric Association. This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley. We had on-air production from Rhonda Fanning. And thank you for listening this afternoon. I'm John Munson, and for Kathleen Dunn, that's no joke. It's the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.